Hello, and welcome to Human Rights Unscripted, a podcast from the American University Washington College of Law that takes a deep dive into the human rights field through candid interviews with professionals, professors, and students. My name is Sydney Larson, and I'm here with my co-producer, Abigail Rosenthal, and our podcast team. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy this episode of Human Rights Unscripted. Today we are joined by Professor David Snyder. Professor Snyder is a professor of law and director of the Business Law Program at the American University Washington College of Law, and a professeur invité at Université Paris II, Panthéon Alsace. He is an elected member of the American Law Institute, a titular member of the International Academy of Comparative Law, and has served on the board of directors of the Washington Foreign Law Society and the board of editors of the American Journal of Comparative Law. He currently chairs the American Bar Association Business Law Section Working Group to draft human rights protections in international supply contracts, and also chairs the Implementation Task Force for the ABA Model Business and Supplier Policies on Labor Trafficking and Child Labor. Professor Snyder, thank you for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Professor Snyder, to get started, could you please tell us what you're working on that brings human rights and contracts together?
Absolutely. I'm working on a project that has come up with model contract clauses for businesses to use in their international supply chains, so we can use the supply contracts to protect the human rights of workers internationally, and also protect other non-product values like environmental sustainability, which actually many countries see as part of human rights protection. So that's what the project is about, and recognizing the contracts control so much in terms of the real life of companies and the real impact on the ground. We want to take advantage of that.
As someone that has primarily studied human rights, I often find myself thinking that human rights law and the law of international contracts are very separate domains of law, but that's not necessarily true. Could you please tell us a little bit about the nexus of these two subjects and the role that human rights play in international transactions?
Well, thanks for asking about that, because I think it's a really important point, really drives to the heart of the matter. One of the ways I like to think of it is, you know, businesses have a tremendous impact on the world. And sometimes in the field of business and human rights, the idea is, okay, businesses are out there doing terrible things and we need to advocate for them to do better things. And that's all fine. But part of what we need to see is that the businesses can have a really positive impact. You know, the point is they're huge, they're multinational, they affect the economy, they affect the environment, and they affect real people in very real ways. And part of the thought behind my work has been working with the businesses, within the businesses, we can do a lot of good. And that's also part of what I hope that students and others in the human rights field will see, is how much positive impact you can have in working with the businesses. And that's what I've tried to do.
How is it that you became interested in the human rights side of business?
What happened was, I do contracts and commercial law, including sales of goods, and including a lot of their international and comparative aspects. In fact, my work is both U.S. and international, and a lot of it is international. It's always seemed to me that, you know, we all are, you know, we're professionals and all of that, and, you know, that's important. But we're actually, you know, we're also people. And as people, we have our own moral responsibilities. I started thinking about, well, you know, how could I do something about this? And I'm a law professor, so I thought, well, the first thing to do is start studying it. And that's what I did. One thing has led to another, and I can tell you more about that, but that's the basic answer to, you know, how I got into it.
Would you mind telling us a little bit more about the projects that you've taken on and the research that you've done?
You know, the way I first got into it was there were these sweatshop scandals in the 90s, and I thought, you know, I wonder what's going on the contractual side of this. And I heard that the companies were adopting codes of conduct, and I was looking at them. I thought, you know, what's going on the contract side? Because the contract side is really what controls things. And so I wasn't very optimistic, but I decided that one summer, a research assistant and I would call and email big companies that had issues with this and ask them for their contracts. And we figured most of them wouldn't give us the contracts, but maybe they'd talk to us and maybe we could get a few. Well, to our amazement, practically everybody just said, sure, here it is. There was one company, I think, that said no. And there was one company that said, let us know before you share this with anybody else. Otherwise, they just like sent us their contracts. So I, you know, collected all these contracts and I read them. And that was super interesting, as it turned out. And I discovered that it actually played into some research and I had done before. The idea of what I had done before was that a lot of law gets privately made. And I made the argument that through contracts, a lot of what actually operates as the real rules that actually are enforced and enforceable really don't come necessarily from legislatures and certainly not like from the UN or something. And what I began to see was that was happening on the human rights side in the wake of the sweatshop scandals. So what you had was these different organizations like, say, the Fair Labor Association or the Worker Rights Consortium or various others. And they said, okay, what we'll do is we'll set, you know, some rules on what you're allowed and not allowed to do, and we can go in and audit and so on. And then what can happen is buyers, like in the developed world, can say, or licensors, like universities were a big one behind it. Like, if you want to put our brand name on this, you better like not be using child slaves.
Would it be the courts in the individual countries where those contracts are enforced that really are the enforcement mechanism of this kind of human rights scheme?
Theoretically, yes. In reality, you don't see a lot of litigation, especially within supply chains and especially among viable companies. You might get some litigation coming out of a bankruptcy, but it's kind of over by then. And even then, it's pretty rare. Like in COVID, we saw surprisingly little litigation, even when there were clear violations of contracts. Litigation is often not viable. And that might lead people to say, well, what did the contracts even matter? And the answer to that is people take them seriously because they can be enforced. And people take them seriously because this is their operational guide. This is tells them what they have to do. In some cases, it may even tell them how they have to do it. So they have a lot of power because of their operational value. That has been our mantra, is legally effective and operationally likely. And people, the operational side gets more serious because the legal side is serious, even if we don't usually see judicial enforcement.
When we see violations of human rights by these companies, how should we treat that?
So that's a great question. To keep the answer with it not too long, you know, the initial problem, as I understood it, was, well, what if they've used forced labor to make the soccer balls? It may well be that the soccer balls are fine. And we saw that as the problem to be solved. The commercial law cares about the soccer balls and the money, right? It's focused on goods and money. And if there's nothing wrong with those, then it seems like everything's fine. And so what we needed to do was draft contracts that realized that actually, let's make it in the contract so it says the soccer ball is non-conforming, even if it's stitched perfectly, if it was stitched with forced labor. And then deal with the problem of, you know, sort of the mismatch between the law and what's really at stake here, which are what I'm calling non-product values. The original conception was, yeah, under, say, the UN Convention on Sales of Goods, the CISG, or under the Uniform Commercial Code, let's say there's a fundamental breach or substantial impairment in the value of the contract. Let's make sure there's a right to call the whole thing off, even though the soccer balls or the T-shirts or whatever may themselves actually be fine. And we thought that was, you know, part of the problem and that we were solving it by coming up with that solution. The thing is, pretty one of the few things that practically everybody agrees on is you don't want everybody to cut and run. That's actually tends, except in the most egregious situations, that tends to be bad for everybody involved. The workers often wind up in even worse positions. Cutting everything off is not necessarily good, even for the workers. It's not good for the suppliers because obviously, you know, they're losing their business. And although the other thing that could happen is they may say, oh, well, you know, these, you know, goody two shoes buyers are cutting us off, but we can always sell our goods to somebody else. So that's hardly helping matters on the supplier side of things. And then on the buyer side of things, cutting everything off isn't good for them either because, you know, now they need to go find other suppliers and make sure they can find good ones and, you know, that sort of stuff. So you don't want termination. You want remediation. You want to fix the problem. Now, again, there are sometimes exceptions like zero tolerance. And, you know, you may have to deal with things separately if you send an auditor in and they find that the workers are being kept in locked barracks. And, you know, we have truly egregious situations. But a lot of forced labor situations, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners know, it's sort of a multi-factor analysis. And it may well be, well, actually, what we need to do is deal with the fees that are owing. And, you know, maybe we can get those paid off. We can make this more voluntary, et cetera. And let's fix the problem rather than cut everything off. That's probably not going to make problems go away.
Professor Snyder, have you seen any interesting developments regarding the inclusion of human rights provisions in international contracts?
Well, I mean, something that's been tremendous is the European Union proposed directive on corporate sustainability due diligence, and they put out their draft, and contractual assurances and model contract clauses are central to what they're doing. And I was really glad to see that. It's really interesting and I think a really important move, and to me a crucial move, because as I say, just as a business matter and as an operational matter, as well as a legal matter, the contracts are what control things. That's been a huge development and it has brought a lot more attention to the projects that we've done, which are about model contract clauses to implement human rights or other similar protections in international supply chains.
Could you tell us a little bit about the model contract clauses?
Yeah, so the current version of the model contract does a few things that I think are pretty interesting and really important. One is, you know, the whole idea is to be legally effective and operationally likely. So, you know, we want this to be good contract law. So, you know, these are good contracts based on what the law is. And we need people really with good knowledge of the contract side of the law. That has been crucial because that means the companies and their counsel take them seriously. And if the lawyers take them seriously, then the operations people tend to take them seriously. And, you know, it's sort of a virtuous circle. So we've wanted to make sure legally effective and operationally likely. And that's been true throughout. But in the second version, one of the things we've done is tried to implement a sense of shared responsibility. Buyer and supplier are both committing to do human rights due diligence.
Could you explain what due diligence is?
What we want is both parties to say, we're going to look and figure out what's going on. And when we find problems, we're going to fix them. And so that's the idea of human rights due diligence from both parties, and then remediation by the parties who either caused or contributed to those problems. And this is very much based on the UN guiding principle on business and human rights. So we have a couple things there. Shared responsibility, rather than buyer saying, supplier, you have to assure us everything is perfect. Two is human rights due diligence instead of representations and warranties. Three is remediation as the main point in the contract rather than termination. And then we've put in other ideas. There's something in the UN guiding principles called an operational level grievance mechanism. Terrible name. The idea is there needs to be a way, like an 800 number or a Dropbox or something where workers can say anonymously if they need to, you know, here's a problem, this is going to need fixing. And we need to engage with stakeholders beyond just the buyers and suppliers. So if there's, you know, problems in, let's say, the villages or the communities or with the environment or whatever, we can identify those problems and get them fixed.
Now, when you're talking about we, when you're talking about the model contract clauses, who is that we?
This comes, so the model contract clauses come out of the business law section of the American Bar Association. And I should say it is not official ABA policy. That was the group at first, was really just business lawyers in the business law section.
And what effect, if any, did the pandemic have on this process?
COVID curiously helped with this. For one thing, it focused people's attention on supply chains in a way that nobody had ever paid attention before. And secondly, we all were working on Zoom all the time. And so what in the old days would have been an expensive and protracted research project, which, you know, if you're going to be taken seriously, you were going to have to spend a lot of time in South Asia and East Asia and maybe South or Central America and so on. We arranged all these Zoom meetings. So I, you know, think back to the summer of, I guess it was 2020, and like being on Zoom and watching like cars in Lahore, Pakistan, like going by in the background as I'm talking to suppliers there or in Cambodia or various other places. And it sort of normalized it. And so we talked to lots of people, dozens of people, organizations, and that's companies, NGOs, et cetera, et cetera. And so the working group is still within the business law section. And technically, I don't know whether it is allowed to include all the other members. But what I generally say is if you're in the to line of my email, you know, I'm listening. We're all listening to each other. And that to line includes lots of people from lots of different perspectives, which has made life more interesting. But anyway, it's moved us a lot.
That's incredible. Could you tell me a little bit about the UN guiding principles and the effect that those have had, if any?
Oh, well, I think they've had a big effect. The UN guiding principles are principles that came out about 10 years ago, and the American Bar Association did officially adopt those, which sort of made our lives easier. It's like, okay, you know, that's something that is ABA policy, and they've been very successful. As I said, lots of companies are interested, and the other group leaders and I spend a lot of time talking to people in companies who are interested in the clauses. And we say, you know, a lot of you have said you're going to follow the UN guiding principles, and you're probably not doing much of anything. This allows you to implement those. And it's really about recognizing companies' responsibilities with respect to the human rights impacts of their operations. And, you know, if they cause or contribute to a harm, then they really need to fix it. And there needs to be responsibility. There needs to be remedy. Now, what all that means, not everybody agrees on, and we've had some debates about that. You know, some people may think that, you know, that means we get to sue you. That's what a remedy means. And the company may feel like, no, it does not mean you get to sue us, but you do get to tell us about it and maybe make this public, or we may have a non-judicial enforcement mechanism or something along those lines. But that's the idea of the UN guiding principles.
So you said that a lot of businesses do want to comply with their international human rights obligations. What are some things that you've seen that stand in the way?
I think I'd like to be a little more careful on what I think it is that companies want to do. I don't think I want to say that my experience is that they want to comply with their international human rights obligations. That may well be true, but I'm not so sure. What I am much more sure of is that they want to do the right thing. So why don't they just go ahead and do it? Well, a lot of it is just inertia. Like, things have worked this way, and if you're going to change things, well, it's a lot of trouble and expensive. This particular change is pretty complicated. Once you start changing things or saying you're going to change things, you may be willing to go, you know, this far, and they want you to go that far, which is like 10 times farther. And you're like, oh, now I'm in trouble. And in fact, some of the companies that are very forward thinking that we've talked to said, we actually don't want to do anything right now. With all the problems going on in China and so on, I mean, we want to do that, but we don't want to do anything publicly because we'll lose control. On top of what I said before, which is time, expense, uncertainty, and then just priorities. Like, yes, we want to do it. It's one of our top 10 priorities, maybe even our top five. It's just like the nature of businesses or life in general is like you're lucky to get past two. So I think those things all stand in the way. And, you know, we're trying to help with that. To some degree, you know, what the EU is doing can really change things because companies do things that they have to do. Mm-hmm. And many companies are going to have to do something.
What do you see as the future from here?
What I see as the future has to do with even larger movements than this. So if you look at the biggest picture things in our world and our economy, one of them is technology. The internet changed everything, and that's now old news. And you know, there's some idea that blockchain or other distributed ledger technologies are changing everything. Something that you don't hear people talk about as much, but that I think are really important, satellites and satellite technology changes a lot. What I want you to recognize is how much easier mapping and tracking can be if you can do satellite tracking all over the world. Technology makes monitoring and enforcement much more possible. And I think that's going to be an important part of the future. Something that goes with that is another huge economic movement. The names for it have changed over the decades, but you know, sometimes it was called outsourcing or globalization. What economists would say is what we're having is vertical disintegration. It used to be that, say, a car company would make all the parts of the car and put them together and sell the car. Nowadays, you know, the car company doesn't really do that. Other people make parts that they sell to other people who put those parts into like a system, which they then sell to the car company. It's actually much more complicated. Yada, yada. You get that idea. Same thing with, say, an apparel company. They're buying the stuff from someone else and then selling it. So what used to be managerial functions within a company now have to happen through contracts. So when we put together new technological possibilities for mapping, tracking, monitoring, and enforcement, and vertical disintegration, I think the wave of the future has to take advantage of both contracts and technology. And my guiding principle for myself through all this has been whatever it is the companies are doing to manage their supply chains in general, to figure out like timing and cost and pricing and quality control and intellectual property control and so on, I want to put the human rights and environmental pieces with that. I don't want it separated out. If the good management is taking advantage of contracts and technology and systems engineering, we need to have the human rights and environmental side coming in there. So it's really seeing things from within the business, operational, and legal perspective.
Well, Professor Snyder, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss this very important topic. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And to our listeners, we hope you have enjoyed this episode of Human Rights Unscripted.